It's really, really nice to be here and be in this meeting. So I'm going to tell you about a project I'm working on with Ofa Aharoni, Nima Arkani-Hammad, Toby Wiseman, and perhaps some other people. The list of authors is to be determined. The title of the project is Plasma Balls in Large End Confining Gauge Theories. If you don't know what a plasma ball is, that's not surprising. It's a term we've coined to describe something that comes up in our work, and I hope to describe to you what a plasma ball, what we call a plasma ball. Okay, so the outline of my talk is written on the board. I'm going to start with an introduction and motivation, try to motivate the study of this project. I'll then tell you about the behavior of plasma balls, firstly from plasma fluid dynamics, and then describe the decay of these objects. Then describe their dual description using the ADS-EFT correspondence. Just what the terms in the outline mean will become clearer as I proceed with the talk. Okay, so let's start with the motivation. Okay, consider a string theory. Consider a string theory at weak coupling. If you take the coupling of the string theory to be arbitrarily weak, we know that the theory has several nearly stable excitations, okay? Namely, all the excited string states. We've got a whole lot of almost stable states in the theory, all these nearly excited string states. Their stability follows immediately from the structure of string perturbation theory. Any diagram for the decay of these modes would be suppressed by powers of the string coupling. Okay. So that works very well, and you could sort of predict the existence of these stable string states as long as their energies were small compared, you know, as long as the energies of these states didn't scale by, like, some inverse power of the string coupling. Now you might have thought of asking the question, suppose we looked at string theory and asked, suppose I took the glue ball masses, sorry, these excited string state masses, to be large, to in fact scale with some inverse power of the string coupling. Let's say like 1 over g squared. Okay? Does the string theory still have nearly stable blobs of energy in it? And of course, we know the answer to that question. The answer is yes. String theory, at least in flat space, has these nearly stable blobs of energy. These blobs are called black holes. They're nearly stable because black holes decay only quantum mechanically through Hawking radiation, so they take a very long time to decay when the string coupling is very small. Okay, so this is a more or less trivial observation about the structure of the excitations of string theory at weak coupling. Now we've all grown used to the fact that gauge theories are secretly string theories. Okay, and 1 over n plays the role of the string coupling constant. So you might ask if all these statements I've made have parallels in gauge theories. Okay. So firstly, do gauge theories at large n. So let's stick to all through my talk, I'll be talking about confining gauge theories at large n. Okay? So suppose we looked at confining gauge theories at large n. You might ask, do these confining gauge theories have a spectrum of particles, first focusing on particles that whose energy is small compared to, it doesn't scale like some power of n. Does it have some spectrum of nearly stable particles? And of course, we know the answer is yes. There are glue balls, and they're stable for standard 1 over n counting reasons, so shown by Toft and Witten and so many other people. Okay, now this might motivate you to ask the second question. The gauge theories, does this phenomenon of having stable excitations continue when the energy of the excitations is not of order 1 but scales like some positive power of n? The power of n we'll be concerned with is n square. So do gauge theories have stable lumps of energy where the energy of this lump scales like n square? Okay? So that's the question we're going to ask in this talk. And I'm going to try to try from several points of view to tell you that the answer in some gauge theories, and I'll tell you the conditions for this as we go along, that the answer is yes. And in a class of gauge theories, at least, these lumps will exist and be dual to black holes in the dual description. Details will follow as we go along. Okay, so this is the motivation and outline of what I'm going to be talking about. Questions? Yes. Okay. Yeah. Generically, they will have negative specific heat, as we will see. Nonetheless, they will be largely stable in the sense that their lifetimes will scale like a positive power of n. So they're unstable, they take a very long time to decay, just like a Schwarzschild black hole in flat space. Okay, good. So let's go on. So I'm going to start in a very elementary manner. I'm going to start by talking about the fluid dynamics of plasma fluids. So what do I mean? As all of you know, confining gauge theories which have only adjoint matter, the only kind of gauge theories I'll be talking about in a moment, okay, confining gauge theories with only adjoint matter have interesting thermodynamics. When you heat up these gauge theories at some temperature, which is typically of order the length scale in the theory, lambda QCD, the theory undergoes a deconfinement transition. Okay? There's a sharp deconfinement transition. There's a sharp order parameter for this transition, expectation value of the Polyakov loop around the time circle. Okay. Once you cross this transition at high temperatures compared to the transition temperature, the gauge theory behaves rather differently from its low temperature behavior. In particular, you should think of the space as being filled with some sort of gluon plasma. What will be of importance to me is that the energy density, rho, which is E by volume of this plasma, is of order n square. When this confining gauge theory has its large n gauge theory. And this is true not just of the energy density, but also, say, of the free energy density, and therefore of all interesting thermodynamic quantities, in particular the pressure. The pressure of the system is n squared times some function of temperature. Okay? This is true in the high temperature phase. Okay. So you should think of this high temperature phase as being some space filled with some gluon plasma. Of course, the low temperature phase of the gauge theory behaves rather differently. In the low temperature phase, the energy density and the pressure are each of order 1. Okay. So what we're going to ask is the following. Suppose we've got a lump of this fluid, of the high temperature fluid, okay? So it's a plasma of this gauge theory at temperatures higher than the deconfinement transition temperature of the theory. We've got some localized lump of this fluid. We prepare it somehow and let it roll. We let it evolve. Can this localized lump of gluon plasma stabilize into some nearly stable configuration of plasma? That's the question we're asking. Okay? So it's localized, it's not filling all of space. It's surrounded by the gauge theory in the vacuum. Can we have some sort of stable lump of this plasma sitting inside vacuum? Okay. So we're going to ask this question in several steps. In the first step of trying to answer this question, we're going to try to ask it like the people who study the fireball that's created at Rick do, namely by modeling what happens with this fluid plasma through fluid dynamics. In the next step of analysis, we'll be more sophisticated and remember the fluid came from a gauge theory. But for the first step, we'll just forget about that. Okay? So, what I'm going to try to do is to study the fluid dynamics of this gluon plasma and try to demonstrate to you that under certain rather broad conditions, there's a stable localized lump of plasma sitting in flat space. Okay. Now, in order to study the fluid dynamics, I need to know something about the equation of state of this fluid. But in order to reach my conclusion, I'll need to know remarkably little about this equation of state. And the only fact that I'll actually use comes about, that I will use, follows immediately from the assumption, and this will be an assumption through the rest of my talk, that the deconfinement transition temperature, the deconfinement phase transition of this theory, is of first order. Okay? So that's not something you can derive from logic. Some gauge theories could have second order phase transitions. Some gauge theories could have first order phase transitions. The only gauge theory where this question has been answered in detail through lattice simulations, namely pure Yang-Mills theory, pure SUN Yang-Mills theory, does have a first order transition. I also give you arguments that's generic for theories with a gravity description, a dual gravity description under certain conditions. But anyway, we're going to focus on those theories that have first order deconfinement phase transitions. Okay, now, so there's some temperature Tc at which this theory undergoes a phase transition from this high temperature to low temperature phase. Because the transition is of first order, the gluon fluid exists as a metastable thermodynamic phase both above and below this deconfinement transition temperature. Okay? Now, what I'm going to do now is to argue for you that the pressure of this gluon fluid has a special property, and that special property is that F of Tc is equal to 0 up to corrections of order 1 over n squared. So it's really of order 1 over n squared. Okay? And the argument for that is actually remarkably simple. This system undergoes a phase transition at the phase transition temperature Tc. Whenever a system undergoes a first order phase transition, the pressure of the low temperature of the two phases involved, the low temperature and the high temperature phase, have to be equal. This follows from simple thermodynamics, or more physically, because it follows immediately when you realize that when a system undergoes a first order phase transition, you have configurations of bubbles of one phase inside the other that can only be stable if the two pressures are equal. Okay? So the fluid plasma has the same pressure as the confined phase at the phase transition temperature. But we've already seen that the pressure of the confined phase at the phase transition at every temperature is order 1. That tells you that there's something special about the pressure of the deconfined phase at the phase transition temperature, namely that instead of being of order n squared, it's of order 1, namely that this function here, which is some smooth function of temperature, is 1 over n squared, and the large n limit goes through 0 at the deconfinement temperature. Okay, now that we've understood this, it's rather simple to see that there is a static solution of fluid dynamics which has a localized lump of plasma. Suppose you consider a lump of plasma which is sort of homogeneous in its center, but is statically symmetric and has some radius r. I want to know when this lump, whether there's a static solution that looks like this. Well, I'm going to model the system rather simply. The edge effects are complicated to take into account. When the ball is large enough, you should be able to model them just by a surface tension. So then you go to an undergraduate in physics and ask him how to set up this force balance condition, and he'll tell you that you've got to match 2 pi r times the surface tension with pi r squared times the pressure, because that's how forces balance. Okay, so this sphere would be in equilibrium when the pressure is given by sigma, 2 sigma divided by r. Okay, so here I've thrown in the second assumption, and this will be the last assumption that will be important for my talk. The assumption is that the surface tension of the interface between the confined and the deconfined phase in everything I'm going to be doing is going to be assumed to be positive. That sounds like a very reasonable, or rather generic assumption to me, but anyway, I don't have a proof, so it's going to be an assumption. Okay, so suppose you have this condition, and what you see is that you get an equilibrium situation when the pressure is 2 sigma divided by r. Now, of course, there's an interesting limit, namely the limit r goes to infinity. So when this ball becomes very large, when the pressure goes to zero. But we know at what temperature the pressure goes to zero. From the argument I just gave you, the pressure goes to zero at the deconfinement temperature. Okay? So ball of fluid at the deconfinement transition temperature, when the ball is rather large, will be a static solution of this fluid dynamical problem. When the ball is not strictly infinite, the pressure will be a little higher than zero. And if the system has positive specific heat, that happens at a slightly higher temperature than the deconfinement temperature. Okay? So this ball, when it's very large, is at the deconfinement temperature. When it becomes smaller and smaller and smaller, goes to higher and higher temperatures. That's why the system has negative specific heat. Okay? It's a static solution of fluid dynamics. The next question is whether it's a stable static solution of fluid dynamics. Okay? And under the assumptions I've talked about, using the assumption that sigma is positive, it's easy to demonstrate that's true. Okay, there are three kinds of modes you have to worry about, and they're mixing. One kind of mode is just a homogeneous expansion or contraction of the fluid. Okay? It's clearly stable under that kind of mode, because when you expand it further, you dilute the energy density, temperature goes down, the pressure goes negative and pulls it back. Compress it, the reverse happens. The next kind of mode you have to worry about is density fluctuations. But density fluctuations are basically governed by this, you know, a wave equation that has the speed of sound in this fluid. As long as the specific heat of the system is positive, as it is in any such system, of the infinite phase is positive, as it is in any such system, these density fluctuations basically will be stable. The last kind of fluctuations you have to worry about are fluctuations of the surface. Okay, as long as the surface tension is positive, it's intuitive, and you can easily show that these surface fluctuations are also stable. Okay? So just as a fluid dynamical problem, this lump of fluid is a stable solution of fluid dynamics. Okay, in a confining gauge theorem. Okay, but all of you are thinking, that's all very well, but strongly coupled gauge theories are not just fluids. I mean, you know, Napier and Stokes were in the last century, and we're advanced people now, and this is too crude. Okay, and that's true. Okay, so clearly this lump of fluid is not arbitrarily stable. Clearly it's not, because the net energy density of the system, because the system has infinite volume, is zero, and the stable thermodynamic phase with zero energy density is the confined phase. So clearly this ball of fluid is going to eventually hadronize into gas of glue balls. Now, an interesting question, an interesting and important question from my point of view, is how long this hadronization procedure takes. Okay, now, the hadronization procedure is, of course, complicated, strongly interacting problem in the gauge theory. And it would be very hard to say anything exact about this hadronization temperature as a function of, you know, to calculate things exactly. However, it is actually rather easy to compute the N dependence, of the rate of hadronization, as I'm now going to explain to you. Okay? So what I'm going to demonstrate to you is that the lifetime of this plasma ball, while it's not infinite, actually is of order n squared. Times some function of, you know, lambda is blah, 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 some number I can't determine, but it's of order n squared. Okay? And the argument for this, you know, it basically follows and really uses Toft's classic argument for counting powers of n in gauge theory, perturbation theory, in a rather simple way. So let me proceed with that argument. Okay, so this plasma ball here, when it's big, it's this gas of gluons, that are roaming around and bumping into each other once in a while. Hadronization occurs when two gluons bang into each other and produce a glue ball, which can then escape from the mess. So we want to compute how often that happens. Okay, so let's draw a diagram that contributes to this process. So suppose we've got two gluons coming in. It produces a third gluon and a glue ball. Okay, that's planning. Okay, so these are two specific gluons coming in, producing a third gluon and a glue ball. In order to compute the rates for this happening, I'm going to take the initial states to be gluons, final state to be some gluon, and a glue ball. The glue ball is produced by, is created by an operator like, for instance, trace F squared, you know, some sort of singlet operator that has non-zero projection when acting on the vacuum. Okay. Now, what I'm interested in is how often these glue balls are produced per unit time. No, I don't care how many other gluons are produced or how many gluons go into making the collision. I just care about the net inclusive cross-section, net inclusive rate of production of glue balls. Okay, so I want to take an amplitude like this, mod square it, and sum over all initial and final states. But now there's a convenient way of mod squaring in amplitude. That's just by multiplying the diagram by its complex conjugate. Yes, okay, so let me draw the complex conjugate, which I always find challenging. Of this diagram here. So I'm going to multiply these two diagrams together. Now I have to sum over all initial and final states. Now, I'm only interested in the end dependence. So the summing over all initial and final states, I only care about the fact that I have to sum over all initial and final states of the color states of the incoming and outgoing gluons. So in order to achieve that summation, there's a simple trick. Just take this diagram, complete it up. Complete it up like I've shown you here. And then sum over all color lines in this diagram in an unconstrained fashion. That achieves exactly what we want. It achieves exactly what we want because internal lines have to be summed over anyway in computing the amplitude. And you're summing over external lines as a trick to sum over all initial and final states, where you're here using what you know, namely that the number of gluons of any given color is of order 1 in the deconfined phase. Okay? So the independence of the inclusive glue ball production cross-section is very easily obtained. Just take any graph that you could imagine that contributes to this thing, square it by doing this procedure, and compute the independence. But now we've reduced the n-counting of this graph to the classic problem of Toft. We know what the independence of this graph is. It's n to the power 2 into 1 minus g. Almost. Almost, because we've not been careful about these insertions. You see, these insertions here come with their own powers of n so as to be normalized to produce a glue ball with unit amplitude. What normalization must they have? Well, you can easily convince yourself. But suppose we computed the two-point function of such an insertion. By the usual Toft rules that we've just outlined, this two-point function would be of order n square. In order that these operators are normalized so that the two-point function is of order unitary rather than n square, we have to take these operators and normalize them with a factor of 1 over n each. So the n dependence of this graph really is n to the power 2 into 1 minus g into 1 over n to the power 2k, where k is the number of glue balls. Of the number of glue balls that are created. Okay. So that's nice. Now that we know this answer, let's interpret it. Okay, so let's take. Of course, we're interested in the leading n behaviors. We'll set g to 0. So let's first take k equals 0, and we get the answer n squared. What does that mean? That tells you that the net number of gluon-gluon collisions that produce no glue balls that occurs in this plasma ball is of order n squared per unit time. Okay, what about k equals 1? K equals 1 is a real case of interest because this is a situation where a glue ball is produced. Okay? So K equals 1, this answer there becomes 1. That tells you that the net number of gluon-gluon collisions that happen in this plasma that produce a glue ball is of order 1. Okay. Now you might think that this is rather strange. There are some intuitive words one can put to this result to make it more believable. The intuitive words are simply as follows. You've got gluons that are going around and hitting each other. The rate at which these collisions happen is of order n squared. But not all of these collisions can form a glue ball. See, because a glue ball has the property that's singlet. So in order for a gluon to be able to collide with another gluon and form a glue ball, the two gluons have to be very finely tuned. Given any one gluon, the only other kind of gluon that can collide with, in order to form a singlet, has to have the opposite color charges as itself. But only 1 over n squared of the gluons have the opposite color charge as any given gluon. That's that extra suppression factor of n squared, which is what takes n squared and makes it 1. Okay, so what have we concluded? We've concluded here that if we take this plasma ball, and we remember that its energy is of order n squared, we sit and watch at what rate any given glue ball is radiated from this plasma ball, the rate of radiation is order 1. Okay, now I want to use this to conclude that this plasma ball lives for very long, and I'm almost there, because I've said the rate of radiation, rate of loss of energy is order 1, energy is order n square, sounds like a lifetime of order n square. There's one possible out, though, that you might have, so I have to comment on that. And the possible out is comes from the fact that the number of final states in a gauge theory at final n is at large n is infinite. So you have to be careful that there might be some sort of divergence from that. Okay? So the number of glue balls at energy whose mass is of order m, so the number of glue balls whose mass is of order n, of m, scales like e to the power beta h times m. This is the famous Hagedorn growth in the density of states of a confining gauge theory. By the way, I recently learned that Hagedorn did his work in gauge theories, not string theories. You know, so I was when I 6 months ago I would have said, like we know from string theory, you know, but it's really Hagedorn growth. Okay, so the net rate of energy loss, okay, the net rate of energy loss then is given by a formula that goes something like as follows. It has e to the power beta h times m times the amplitude to produce a glue ball of mass n. Now, since this thing diverges so exponentially, you might worry that this whole integral diverges. Okay. So, of course, the convergence of this integral, which is what we want to talk about, depends on the growth on the behavior of A of n. Okay. Now, I'm going to make a physically intuitive guess for the behavior of A of m at large energies. By the end of this talk, we'll see that, at least in some examples, this intuitive guess is borne out by a gravitational dual description. Okay? But the guess I'm going to make goes as follows. See, this lump here is essentially a thermal state. Okay? So we've got a thermal state with a well-defined temperature. Okay? So whenever you have a thermal state with a well-defined temperature, if you want to ask, how often does it produce, you know, some excitation of whose energy is of order E, typically that at large enough energies, that rate is governed by Boltzmann factor. Okay? So my guess, and as I say in some examples, I will give you evidence this is true, my guess is that this A of M scales like e to the power minus beta C T. The beta C is beta corresponding to the critical beta C M. And now we use a well-known property, an almost obvious property of confining gauge theories. The property is that whenever you have a confining gauge theory that undergoes a first-order deconfinement transition, its deconfinement transition temperature is lower than its Hagedorn temperature. Okay, strictly lower. So that, using that property, plugging this into here, you see that this integral converges. This integral converges, and everything's fine. Okay? So that ends my motivation of the analysis from gauge theory, which I will now try to summarize in 2 minutes before moving on to dual description of some of these things. So my summary is as follows. I claim that whenever you have a gauge theory, a confining gauge theory that undergoes a first order deconfinement transition, and it's such that the surface tension between the confined and deconfined phase is positive, then there's a fluid dynamically stable ball of plasma in this theory. Fluid dynamically is just stable. When you remember this is a gauge theory, it eventually decays by radiating glue balls. This radiation is approximately thermal at the phase transition at the temperature of the plasma ball, which is when the plasma ball is large enough, is the deconfinement temperature. Okay, and the rate of loss of energy then is of order 1. The energy of the ball is of order n squared. This thing lives for a very long time in the large n limit, namely a time of order n squared. Okay, questions, comments? Yes. Uh, well, I mean, in my mind, the space has been non-compact, but I don't think it matters. You see, in any gauge theory, basically, in any confining gauge theory, there's a correlation length scale for the lambda QCD. As long as the space is much larger than that, what we're doing is localizing a lump of plasma inside the confined phase. Okay, so out here, it's confined dynamics that's important. So there are two conditions. So your plasma ball. Oh, by the way, we call this lump a plasma ball. Okay, it's like a glue ball, a plasma ball. Okay, so this lump here has to be smaller than your space, the question, and the space has to be large compared to lambda QCD. Those are the two set of conditions. Yes. Yes. No. So this is the density of states of glue balls. Okay. So this is not the density of states of plasma balls. The density of states of glue balls. Okay. So right. So because that was what was relevant here, because we were what? Yeah. Yes. Well, you see, I'm not using any details of perturbation theory. Just a question of I see. Good. So that's a good question. You see, but once again, the only thing I use from perturbation theory is the idea that the number of I said that the number of gluons of any given color is of order one. Okay. Now you could say you shouldn't word it that way. Well, I could have worded it like this. I could have said that the state has some wave function, okay, for these gluons, which is always true, okay, and then just some assumption about the color properties of this wave function that would amount to saying that roughly the number of gluons per unit color is of order one, okay. That's basically all I've used. You see, so I take your point. The way I've worded it, it sounds like I'm doing something illegible, but I don't think that's true. You know, all I'm doing is using color distribution properties. Yes. Factorization. Yes. There are no. That there are no what? Uh huh. Yes.
So, in that sense, you don't have to invoke gluons or anything of that.
Yeah. I think it's true that this is just follows that the independence of this thing can be argued more without using the word gluon. Okay. I should say I've not tried to make that argument formally, but I think that I don't think that that is really a problem. Yeah. Yes, yes. But you see, I'm not inserting operators of states that are very heavy. You see, so what I'm doing is the following. I'm working in the deconfined phase, and I'm inserting operators of usual glue balls. Okay? So what the assumption that was pointed out, and it's a good point, I think, is that the way I'm modeling working in the deconfined phase is by saying that can be modeled by scattering of gluons. So I don't think this is right. So if you were really scattering gluons to produce glue balls, I'm not using large N counting for anything that it doesn't apply to. Now the question is that, you know, in the way I've worded this, I've made the assumption that the state of gluons is sort of uncorrelated. The question is, of course, there are correlations of some wave function. Okay, can you take that into account? I'm pretty sure for the N dependence that doesn't matter. Yeah, it's like doing this calculation at finite temperature. Okay, and maybe that's a way to say it. Okay, it would be like computing the two-point glue ball correlate at finite temperature. ignoring the edge effects, okay? For which, of course, you can make the standard large n counting. Mark. Very good, very good. So, so Mark's question is, these things are produced, but do they actually escape? Okay? Now, of course, the answer is not always, because all these graphs that I've talked about, I've drawn a graph and I've interpreted it as giving you the rate of production of blue balls. But just a time reversal of that, okay, would give you the rate of dissolution of a glue ball once it hits the gluon plasma, okay, which is also of order 1. Okay, so what that's telling you is that suppose you've got your plasma ball, you've got a glue ball that's produced here, it'll go some distance, which will typically be of order lambda QCD, and once again dissolve back into the plasma ball. However, the glue balls that are produced at the surface, that is within a 1 by lambda QCD distance of the surface, will be able to just escape out. Some rate. Okay? So this is in some sense like a star. Radiation is a surface rather than a volume effect, even though the production rate I told you about would naively have seemed to scale like volume. We'll see also from the dual description where how we see that. Yes.
So you did a calculation there, you came up with a scaling goes like 1, but you didn't, when you talked about the rate, you didn't talk about any of the geometric factors which are now coming in. But the geometry must scale with the energy, scale,
where, yeah. So if you just do that, well, we know that this lump here describes the phase of field theory at high temperatures. So its thermodynamic properties must be extensive, the first approximation. You know, because there are corrections from the surface. So it's easy to put that in. So if you assume there's just one, the energy density is of order lambda QCD, and you just compute what the lifetime of this bubble is, you get the answer n squared times r, okay, where r is the radius of the bubble, okay, independent of everything else. Lambda QCDs cancel. They cancel from the energy and the rate of radiation. So it just depends purely on the geometric factor. Yes? Inside. You see, the intuition, I think, that you're using for that is that the phase transition is a special point. Okay? But once again, it's important to remember that this is a first-order phase transition. So locally, the plasma doesn't see anything special at the phase transition point. It goes through a phase transition only because far away some in configuration space, there's a better phase. Okay? So locally, it's just behaving like a plasma. Yes, Emmy. Yes, well, clearly I'm working in the Toft limit. Now, well, let's see. So you say that, well, where you have a Yang-Mills description. So let's see. Suppose you had 2 plus 1 dimensional Yang-Mills and just ordinary 2 plus 1 dimensional Yang-Mills. Is it not true that the high temperature phases of order has energy densities of order n square? Well, 2 plus 1 dimensional Yang-Mills is pretty weakly coupled at high energies, so it should be described in terms of gluons. Right? It must be true that it's order n square. I think you're thinking of the M-theory limits, the IR, first going to the IR and then taking high temperatures, which is a different situation. But I think just if you took 2 plus 1 dimensional Yang-Mills, you looked at this high temperature phase, thermodynamics would be of order n square. It's just a question of when can you correctly describe the high temperature phase in terms of gluons. And I think that's true in 2 plus 1 dimensional Yang-Mills. Now, it may not be true in 4 plus 1 dimensional Yang-Mills, but I'll stick to theories that are well defined. Okay, good. Other questions, comments? Good. Oh, and I've used the wrong board here, but since there's nothing deep on this board. Okay, good. Okay, so that was it for what I had to say from the gauge theory point of view. Now let me go to dual description. I'm going to have to hurry a little, unfortunately. I have to start with an irritating disclaimer. And the irritating disclaimer goes as follows. I want to use ADS CFT to understand the dynamics of confining gauge theories. But that's always tricky because the simplest confining gauge theories that exist, like pure Yang-Mills theory or N equals 1 Yang-Mills theory, does not have as yet a known ADS CFT dual. Okay? Moreover, you know, suppose there was some very clever person who told us what the ADS CFT dual was for pure Yang-Mills. It would not be immediately useful for what I want to say now, because it's a very simple general argument to tell you that any such dual description must necessarily be non-gravitational, by which I mean must necessarily not have a good description just in terms of gravity, and the argument that stringy corrections are important. Stringy corrections to the Einstein action must be important in these theories. The argument goes as follows. The argument is that, well, in a theory like pure UN Yang-Mills, we know that there are glue balls. Let's say that we know that the spin 2 glue ball and the spin 3 glue ball each have masses of order lambda QCD. But the spin 3 glue ball must be dual to an excited string oscillator, since all the states in the gravity multiplet are spin 2 or less. Okay? Presumably, the spin 2 or spin 1, blah, 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 glue balls are dual to the graviton state. Anyway, the lowest energy state in the theory is also of order lambda QCD. Just that observation tells you that there's no scale separation between the energies of excited string states and the energies of the graviton in confining gauge theories with single length scale, like pure Yang-Mills theory. Okay? So even if you did have, you know, some nice and beautiful dual description, I wouldn't be able to easily work with it. I wouldn't be able to easily work with it because I wouldn't be able to talk about it just in terms of gravity. However, most of you are familiar with the fact that there do exist dual descriptions of weird confining gauge theories. Okay, these weird confining gauge theories are examples include Witten's original example of compactifying D4 brains and Schwarz circles, the Klebanov-Strassler example, the Maldacena-Nunez example, Polchinski-Strassler example, and so on. All of these examples have the following properties. All of these examples have the following properties. Their degrees of freedom are the degrees of freedom of a gauge theory coupled to some new degrees of freedom at some energy scale. And these new degrees of freedom are chosen very cleverly. Of course, you would never guess how to choose these new degrees of freedom from a gauge theory point of view. They're chosen gravitational reasoning. They're chosen very cleverly so as when coupling to the gauge theory, they give very large masses to all glue balls that are dual to string oscillator states, while leaving the masses of the glue balls that are dual to gravitons white. Okay? Of course, that you see this at work only when you look at the dual description, where you see that there's a gravitational dual and there's some string scale that can be taken to be arbitrarily high. Okay? So as I say, there are several examples. Okay. Now, so these examples have two length scales. There's the length scale of the mass gap. Let's call it lambda gap. And then there's the length scale of new physics. Let's call it lambda prime new physics. Okay? And I'm going to parametrize my theories instead of by these two length scales, by a single length scale and a dimensionless parameter. I'll choose the dimensionless parameter to be the value of the gauge coupling, the value of the Toft coupling at scale lambda prime. Okay? So if this value of the Toft coupling is taken to be very small, then there's a huge separation between these two scales. And roughly you've returned to the physics of an ordinary confining gauge theory with one length scale, like pure Yang-Mills theory. On the other hand, when lambda prime, in this guy, when the Toft coupling becomes large, there's no regime of parameters in which you well describe the theory with a single length scale. The physics of the theory sort of could be qualitatively different. It's in this regime when gravitational descriptions apply. Okay? So that's the end of my disclaimer. I'm only going to be talking about these weird confining gauge theories that have a gravitational description that I can control. Okay? We will have some comments, if I ever get to that part, at the end about how many of these results I expect to continue to ordinary confining case space. Okay. Good. So now the question I'm going to ask is, in these weird confining gauge theories, which I can control from the bulk, what do these plasma balls look like? So, well, let's remember what the plasma balls were. The plasma balls were localized regions of space in which the theory was deconfined. Well, we know from the gravitational point of view what the description of the full deconfined space is. In all the examples I've talked to you about, there exist basically solutions that asymptote to the background of these backgrounds, have the correct asymptotics to be thought of as finite energy excitations around these backgrounds, but have horizons in the IR. So they're brain solutions, translationally invariant brain solutions about the backgrounds I told you about. If we had a little more time, I would go into some more detail into one simple example. For instance, the simplest example, the one I'll talk about more, is the Schirch-Schwarz compactification of a D4 brain. But you can make this all very explicit, okay? You can just write down gravity solutions for the vacuum of this theory, gravity solutions for the deconfined phase of this theory, okay? Okay. So that's the gravity description of the situation in which all of space is covered by this plasma. We're asking, what is the gravity description of the situation in which some region of space is covered by this plasma? Okay. So the gravity description, as we said, in which all of space, and to make this argument, I'm going to take space and compactify it on a large torus. All of space is covered by this plasma, some sort of brain wrapping this space, black brain. Okay, this brain in particular has a horizon. Okay, if this was a torus, we would think of this as some big black hole. Okay, so now the question is, what is the dual description of this thing in which some of space is covered by this plasma? And the answer is, of course, it must be some sort of black hole. Must look like it must have some sort of horizon. And we only want to know what the properties of black holes about these warped backgrounds are. So the question boils down to, can you understand, at least qualitatively, the spectrum of black holes about warped backgrounds of the sort that are dual to gauge theories? Okay. For everything we're going to talk about, I want you to keep a specific example in mind. So the specific example, is this example of Witten that I was talking about, but I'll tell you an even simpler example just of the kind of geometry, just so that we don't have to talk about fluxes and so on. Suppose you look at ADS6 space in Poincaré coordinates and compactify one of the spatial circles. Okay? This is the kind of background that I want you to look at. I'm sorry I got into this. I don't have the time to give you the specific example, so I'll skip this part, try to keep it general. Anyone who's interested can come and ask me later. Okay? In the next 10 minutes, I have a lot to say. So sorry I got into that. Yeah. That's strongly coupled in the ultraviolet? Yes, yes. But you see, yes, or yes, anything interesting that's going to happen is going to happen in the IR part of the geometry. What the UV completion of this theory is will not matter to anything. Okay, good. You could choose the Klebanov-Strassler. Well, I don't know. Maybe that's also. You'll probably find some theory. Polchinski-Strassler is not strongly coupled. Okay, good. So sorry. Okay, so I'm going to skip this example. Okay, I'm just going to tell you. So suppose we've got these warped backgrounds. We want to understand what the spectrum of black holes in these warped backgrounds is. Okay, now suppose we take these black holes that have very small mass. Then we know what the black holes look like. Okay, they look like little 10-dimensional Schwarzschild black holes that go and sit on the IR wall of the geometry. Now at some point, these black holes become big enough so they start seeing the curvature of the ADS-like space. They start seeing the warping. And it's no longer true that these black holes look like little ADS black holes. But the question is, when you make the masses much larger still, is there some sort of qualitative simplification that happens to these black holes? This is a question that was studied by Steve some time ago. And we're going to give you our version of our guess for the answer to this question. In order to motivate our guess, let's approach it from the opposite list. Suppose field theory was in a torus, okay? And we took the big black, we took the limit of very large masses, well, we know what these black holes look like. They're just black brains that wrap the torus in some uniform way. Okay. We also know that the thermodynamics of these black brains is extensive. You know, everything is written as a temperature volume, and free energies or energy is written as function of volume and temperature, scale-like volume. Okay? This had to be if it's dual to some sort of field theory. Okay? So, suppose we were on a torus which was very large, and we were looking at sort of large energies, what would you expect this black hole spectrum to look like? Well, from the field theory, we've seen, of course, the dual should be this plasma ball. The plasma ball locally cannot, if you're sitting in the middle of a plasma ball, you can't locally, by doing local measurements, distinguish this plasma ball from an infinitely big plasma ball. You know, if the plasma ball is the size of the Andromeda galaxy, you can't tell that it's not infinite by doing local measurements. So, what this would suggest is that the spectrum of black holes, when the black holes become massive enough so that they go large mass compared to the critical black hole, namely the one that first starts seeing the curvature of AGS, it becomes locally, it looks like a lump of this black brain, okay, which is cut off at the edges and then smoothly goes over to the confined space. Just one second, sorry. Now, you could ask which black brain? Okay, because there are black brains at every temperature, yeah? And the answer to this question is obvious. You see, well, if this looks like this in the center, it'll be sort of stable in the center. The only way the edges can be stable is if there's no net force on these surfaces, which is simply the condition that the pressure of these black holes, of these black brains, goes to zero when they become very large. Okay? So that's the same statement as we've seen before, as the black brains at the deconfinement temperature. Okay? So this is our guess, and then I'll tell you the evidence for this guess. But just to state it again, that in these warped backgrounds, the spectrum of black holes look like small AGS Schwarzschild black holes. When these localized pancake-like black holes that become bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger as you put more and more energy into them, locally they look like the black brain at the deconfinement temperature. Eventually they'll fill up the torus. Then they'll go nowhere else to expand in the field theory directions. Instead, they'll expand in the radial directions. They don't want to do that at the beginning because you pay some warp factor price in energy to go up. So they only go up when they have no option. Yes, Steve.
There are also these configurations which are not so homogeneous.
Yes. Yes. Yes, I agree. So I should say that Steve, in his paper, he left the question open, but he conjectured that the spectrum of black holes would have horizons that look more like this. And the motivation for that was that if you take linearized gravity about one of these backgrounds and put a delta function source in here and ask where does the Coulomb profile deviate significantly from being non-zero, it looks like this. Okay? Now, the place in which my intuition differs from this one is that, of course, you know, in getting this shape, you put in a localized source. Now, in gravity, in the black hole, the source is sort of dynamically determined. It could well smear out, in which case it would look more like this. Yes?
Are you doing 2 plus 1 gauge theories in this discussion?
Because
in 3 plus 1 ADS, there are exact solutions of localized black holes, right? Yes. It looks like it's flat pancake,
exactly
the same. Yes. Okay, I'm going to have to think about whether that situation fits into my framework. I'm not sure, I should say. My collaborator, Toby Wiseman, said that there was some property of that didn't fit into our framework, but I can't remember what now, so I'm going to... Okay, but I should get back to you about that. That's a good question. Other questions? Okay. Now, this is reasonably specific, but you know, it's a strange prediction for the spectrum of black holes in a theory. For instance, these black holes, as their mass increases, the temperature, and when they're large, their temperature hardly changes. Okay, because locally they look like this thing here, because it changes a little bit according to that kind of formula there. So the pressure won't be exactly zero, but a little larger than zero to balance surface tension. It's only when they're very large does the pressure go exactly to zero. So it's rather strange spectrum of black holes that we're predicting for a large class of warped backgrounds. And it's a strong enough prediction that you need some evidence for this prediction. Yes. What sets the thickness? It's at least in this example we're studying, it's the same as the fall off of the first. You know, suppose you took a graviton and you took the equation del square phi equals zero, and you look at the lowest energy eigenstate. There's an exponential in that wave function. That's the same as the thickness of this black hole, basically. Okay, so so glue balls are localized to this IR brain at the same thickness as the thickness of this black hole.
Do you think that if you had an infinite brain,
yes,
brain stem, isn't that would be unstable? Could you very well solve
that? Not immediately. Yes, you see, the instability of this is simply one of the surfaces. If you made this thinner than this, the only instability is that it has negative pressure, so it pulls in. Okay? Now, Gregory-Laflamme instability from this point of view is the speed of sound going negative. Okay? And that happens at a different point. If you look at the phase diagram of the gauge theory, if you look at the temperature versus energy density, typically gauge theories which undergo first order phase transitions have this curve going like this. Okay? The first order transition happens at some point here. You'd have to go to lower energy densities in order to see this curve up, which is the speed of sound going negative. Okay, but yes, there's an interesting thing to study there for those brains, but it's not at this point. Good. Other questions? Okay, good. Okay, so now evidence. Okay, so in the simplest example, namely this Witten type example of these confining gauge theories, what we've tried to do is the following. We've tried to set up the equation. Okay, so I've told you about how these black holes should exist for arbitrary sizes. The simplest such black hole is sort of when it's very large. Near the boundary of these black holes, this thing looks like the black hole is basically flat. Okay, so if what we're saying is right, there should exist a domain wall solution. A domain wall solution dividing up space into one half of the region where there's a black hole, and the other half of the region, just a Cartesian domain wall, other half of the region where there's no black hole. Okay, so we set up the equations for determining such a black hole solution in the simplest Witten type background, and my collaborator Toby Wiseman has put these equations on a computer and is trying to find solutions. So, a status report of that project, of that approach. It's looking good, okay, and if it had been up to me, I mean, if I was determining, if I had final authority in saying this is a solution, I would say it looks like a solution to me. But Toby's a very careful guy, and, you know, until all his checks work, I can't say that. But it's looking pretty good, okay? But there's no final conclusion on that. Okay, so we may be near having a publishable numerical solution of this sort in the simplest example. That's the thing I want to say. Okay, now could I take 5 more minutes to? Thank you. Sorry. Okay, so now that we've gone through sort of. You think it's a sign from above, huh? Or from Toby? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Okay, good. So now let me assume that the spectrum of black holes is correct for the next 5 minutes. Now we're going to see whether we can, you know, make some money out of this. Can we get interesting physics from this identification of plasma balls with these localized black holes? So of course, with all these dualities, this flow of information in two ways, You can try to understand plasma ball physics from black holes, black hole physics from plasma balls. So let me very quickly tell you about things that would that become interesting if you buy this whole picture. Firstly, the more mundane things. Can we understand aspects of plasma ball physics from black holes? In particular, can we use this dual stuff to justify any of the approximations we used in the gauge theory side? See, remember, one key approximation we used in the gauge theory side was that the rate of emission of glue balls at mass m was thermal. But now this follows immediately from gravity. It follows immediately from gravity because, you see, this plasma ball here is just a black hole. And the black hole decays quantum mechanically through Hawking radiation. We know Hawking radiation is very accurately thermal. Okay? So then, at least in the cases that we talked about, that have this description in terms of gravity, this guess that we made about the emission amplitudes being governed by Boltzmann factor is certainly borne out. That's the first payoff of this identification. Now, for another payoff of this identification, let's reverse this connection. You see, yes, sir. No. If you have a black hole solution, you've got stable black hole solution on this brain, you could ask, how does it decay? It's a very physical question. We know how it decays. It decays through Hawking radiation. Okay? So Hawking radiation is thermal. That's not using thermodynamics. It's using Hawking's calculation. Okay, so let me say it this way. If you want to argue with my claim that glue balls are produced in a thermal manner, you have to say you don't believe in Hawking radiation. That's all I want to say. Now, you might want to say you don't believe in Hawking radiation, but then I'm even happier with this project. We've ruled out Hawking radiation. Okay. Yes. Okay. Sorry? Yes, there could be a classical instability which is not Hawking radiation. Yes, so you have to believe that there is this that this black hole exists and is stable. That's correct. I should say again that basically the only issue, if this kind of the black hole exists in this this pancake-like way, the only issues are with the boundary, because in the bulk it's basically guaranteed to be stable by standard analysis. Okay, so it's really an issue about the surface tension of these. So it would be unstable if it has negative surface tension. Sounds weird, but it's possible. Yes. Yes. Other questions, comments? Yes. Yes. How does it look like? Okay. Good. I should say that. You see, these weirdly shaped black holes look like this, roughly speaking, and they radiate everywhere. But the radiation here doesn't do anything. It goes to the boundary of ADS and bounces back. The time of order lambda QCD. That's dual to Mark's question. You see, glue balls are produced everywhere in this plasma ball, but most of them don't escape. They just come back and dissolve once again to the plasma ball. So the radiation that happens from the surface, well, that escapes. Okay, good. More questions for me. Good. Okay. Let's take this thing and reverse it. We talked about how we got a payoff from Hawking radiation to understand the rate of emission of plasma balls. But now let's take this the other way around. You see, it's long been argued that the ADS-CFT correspondence, and I must be the 1001st person who said this, that the ADS-CFT correspondence tells us that Hawking radiation is a unitary process. Now, that sounds very nice philosophically, but it's sort of unsatisfying until you can produce for yourself a configuration in the gauge theory that is a localized black hole and watch it decay. You know, if you just say it in a very abstract way, God knows how many ways there may be of this thing going wrong. Now, if you buy our whole thing, we have produced for you the dual configuration of a localized black hole, which you can produce in the gauge theory in a large N version of Rick and watch it decay, measure its correlations, and see that Hawking radiation is unitary. Okay, so it's a philosophical point, but yet not one of. Okay. Now, the last 2 minutes, I just want to say 2-3 more things. The first question that one might ask, you know, black holes are pretty weird objects. So if you manage to produce one that you can study in some nice dynamical way in the gauge theory, the immediate question that you've got to ask is, why is it behaving so weird? Okay, so how, in what way does it behave weird? One way that black hole behaves really weird is that you throw anything into it, it's absorbed, no matter how high the energy of the thing that you threw into it. Okay? Now, this sounds very different from a gas, hot gas. You take something and throw it into hot gas. If you throw it at an energy that's much higher than the temperature, it makes a few grazing collisions and zooms through. It's not absorbed by the hot gas. I'm telling you effectively that this black hole is a hot gas of gluons. How is that consistent with the black hole absorbing everything? Okay, there's a sort of nice answer to this question, I believe. And this answer to this question uses this work done by Pulchinski and Strassler on deep and elastic scattering in gauge theories that have gravity description. You see, the key point is that all you had in your hands to throw into black holes are probes that exist dynamically in the theory, which are basically glue balls. Now, the things that it scatters off in the plasma ball is gluons. So in order to ask, do glue balls zoom through the plasma ball or not, you have to ask, what is the glue ball made up of when rewritten in terms of gluons? Now, this is a question of what is the parton distribution function of a glue ball. Now, this was answered by Pulchinski and Strassler in some detail using some general gauge theory arguments and fleshing it out with ADS-CFT for these kinds of weird gauge theories. And they found that the parton distribution function was in fact in the strict limit I was talking about, a delta function around x equals 0. Okay? So, you take this glue ball and you re-express it in terms of gluons. And the gluons are all very, very low energy, no matter how hard you threw the glue ball. Now, though I don't have the time to tell you about it, you can make it more precise in our setting and show precisely that even if you're strict away from the strict gravitational limit, it's true that at every energy, and you believe the Pulchinski-Strassler formulas, no matter how hard you throw this glue ball, you can never produce gluons from it whose energies are larger than lambda QCD. Therefore, it's consistent with your ideas of thermal physics that you take this glue ball and throw it into the black hole, no matter how hard, it'll always be absorbed. Okay. One last turning around and I'll stop here. You can turn this question around now and ask, well, this uses some weird property of glue balls in these strange confining gauge theories. I should emphasize that this property I mentioned is true only of these strange confining gauge theories. In fact, its derivation uses the fact that there is this large separation of dimensions between stringy operators and gravitational operators. Okay? So what if we go back to ordinary confining gauge theories, like large N QCD or N equals 1 QCD? What about in those things? In those things, I've argued that you can still produce plasma balls. There's still some equivalent of a gravitational black hole. Now, where does the black hole behave black? And the answer is no, because the parton distribution functions in ordinary, asymptotically free theories are completely under control at high energies. You can compute them and find that most of the energy in any given glue ball is in a few partons. Okay? So you throw a glue ball at this plasma ball at high enough energies and it just zooms through. Okay? So an equivalent statement is one about the formation of plasma balls. Okay? As we all know, black holes dominate the high-energy physics of any gravitational theory in the sense that high-energy scattering is dominated by black hole production. This is the point Steve emphasized very forcefully in his paper. Okay, so it must be true that plasma ball production dominates the high-energy scattering processes of these weird confining gauge theories. But for the same reason I talked about, namely partons passing through each other when you're hard enough, that's certainly not true in asymptotically free theories. LHC is not expected to produce, a plasma ball, the Rick does. Okay? So we were, once again, you see here that these confining gauge theories have a sort of crossover in behavior. As you tune up this little lambda parameter, when lambda is small and you have normal type behavior, you have plasma balls, which you can think of if you want to think dual to black holes, but they're not very black. They're not dominantly produced in high energy scattering. When you tune up lambda, you have these plasma balls, they are black and they dominantly produce high energy scattering. That's all I wanted to say. Sorry. Thank you. Yeah.